League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy. Thanks for being here for this special episode of the show. It was 25 years ago when Payne Stewart was unfortunately killed in a plane crash. Shocked the golf world that the reigning U.S. Open champion, who had thrilled the golf world just months prior by winning at Pinehurst No. 2, was gone. And that changed a lot of lives forever, including the family of Payne Stewart. But it also changed the life of Mike Hicks, his longtime caddy. And 25 years later, a quarter century after Payne Stewart's passing, that loss is still felt in many ways. But also, his memory is a buoy to so many who knew and loved him. And in this episode, we're fortunate enough to present a conversation with Mike Hicks, talking about his history with Payne Stewart, his life in getting to know him, and what he's been up to in the intervening time since Payne Stewart's passing. Please enjoy this conversation with Mike Hicks. Mike, thank you for doing this. I appreciate it. Where are you located, and what do you do up to these days?
So I'm living in Kingsport, Tennessee. I work for a company called Tour Caddy Collective. We entertain corporate America. I advise everybody check it out, tourcaddycollective.com. Also, I'm starting a school at NC State University to train people basically how to caddy professionally. I was approached about a year and a half ago by an agent. He's having trouble finding caddies for his college kids coming out to play on the Korn Ferry Tour. So he approached me with this idea, and, you know, a year and a half later, we're holding our first school at NC State, February 16th through the 22nd. It's called the Professional Tour Caddy Certificate Program. So, yeah, look, I'm busy. Not caddying anymore, and I'm busy. I walked yesterday, Friday in Pinehurst, and boy, am I out of shape. Oh, it's awful.
With or without the bag?
Well, I had a caddy, so it was no bag. I wasn't carrying, and I was still out of shape. It's terrible.
When was the last time that you played before that?
Caddied or played?
Either.
Caddied last tournament I worked. Actually, I worked two Korn Ferry events back in the spring just to go check it out and see if there was a need for caddies, and there is. I caddied for Spencer Levine a couple of weeks. So that was the last time I caddied. And playing wise, I try to play once or twice a week. Yeah.
And you're playing in the Bristol area?
I was a member at Johnson City Country Club for a little over a year once I moved over here. I'm no longer a member there. My 89-year-old father's caretaker now. So, and my youngest son is off to college, so I don't really have anybody to play with. So I let my membership go for a while because I'm really not playing as much as I'd like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When people realize who you are and who you worked with in Payne Stewart, does the conversation change? Do people's eyes light up? What's the first thing that kind of happens?
I wouldn't say people's eyes light up, but you know, they all, the first question is, you know, was he as good a guy as he seemed to be? And, you know, they want to talk about the, you know, the Knickers, how that all came about, the NFL deal. So, you know, just the basic question is, you know, is he as nice as he seemed to be? And he was. I mean, he was a cool guy. Very, very cool guy.
When did you kind of hit it off with him? I mean, I did kind of have that kind of relationship that you ultimately developed.
So I knew Payne. I mean, I started in 81. I think his first year was 82. And his first caddy, the guy's name was Rob Kay. He was a Canadian kid. And Rob and I were good friends. We traveled together. So I got to know Payne through Rob. And you know, we just we he fired Rob in 80 at the start of 87, and we were in Japan. I was over there with Curtis Strange, and Payne had hired this guy that had never caddied before. And I was on a part-time basis with Curtis, was myself and one other guy that were sharing the bag. And so I went to Payne because I wanted something full-time. And I was working full-time because back in those days, you could fill in. You could find weeks to fill in when you weren't caddying for your regular guy. And so I went to Payne. I said, hey, if the job opens up again, I'd like a shot. So this guy lasted about a month. Payne came to me and said, hey, you want to go try it for 4 weeks, see what happens? And that turned into 12 years.
Did you have an immediate rapport with him? Did you get along with him beforehand? Like what relationship did you have prior to working together professionally?
Yeah, I wouldn't say we were, you know, best friends or anything. You know, like I said, I got to know him through Rob. And Payne, you know, he was diagnosed with ADD. And, you know, back in those days, back in the 80s, you know, nobody knew what that was. So, you know, I knew he was a little bit of an emotional roller coaster as far as, you know, some days he was real jovial and laughable. And the other days he was kind of quiet and seemed down. He was never down on himself, you know, like some golfers are. Like they hit a bad shot, they're, you know, all over themselves or their caddy. He was never like that. So I knew there was a little something there with his emotions, you know, up and down. Once he started working with Dr. Richard Koop in 88, all that changed. You know, this Dick Koop, the sports psychologist from North Carolina, who's rest in peace, he's no longer with us, but, you know, he helped Payne a lot mentally.
How did your temperament line up with Payne's, and was that, how did you kind of figure out how best to work with one another?
Well, it got to the point, I wasn't scared to speak up. I think some of his other caddies, you know, were. Curtis Strange gave me the best compliment. You know, when Curtis would ask me something, I had an answer right away, you know, where there was no hemming and hawing. I was going to give him my opinion when the question was asked, because I was thinking ahead. And that's, as a good caddy, that's what you're doing. You're thinking ahead. You're thinking of the next shot, what might happen, you know, what the conditions are, where you want the ball to be, where you don't want it to be. And back in those days, you never said don't. You never said don't hit it here. Whereas today's game, you know, it's so statistically driven. It's all stats and percentages that, you know, you're telling your guy out there now, we don't want to hit it in this bunker. We don't want to hit it over the green. We don't want to hit it here, hit it there. So it's totally different. You know, back when I started, it was, you know, show up, keep up, and shut up. That was it. I wasn't scared to voice my opinion. And there were many times, you know, I would give him a kick in the rear, you know, like, you know, come on, you know, that was, you know, what are you thinking about there? Stuff like that. And he appreciated that.
Was there a moment in those first four tournaments for either of you, for Payne or for yourself, where like, this is going to work?
I don't know that there was one particular moment, but listen, you know, the guy had a chance to win all four tournaments. We top 10 all four. So we had success. And listen, when you have success with somebody early, you're gonna get the bag. I mean, that's just the bottom line. It really boils down to this, Ryan. If the guy makes putts, you're gonna have the job. When they stop making putts, that's when, you know, things could get a little shaky. It's true though.
It is, but. But you also, obviously, he had the confidence in you that you were going to give him the truth and you were going to give him good information. And he believed that what you were telling him was at least worth listening to and not just outright. Right.
Listen, like I said, I wasn't afraid to speak up. And listen, 2 weeks after I got the job is when he started working with Dick Koop, you know. And Dick was the, like I said, the psychologist at North Carolina. And I lived in Hillsboro, which was 8 miles away. So when Dick would come in or when Payne would come in to work with Dick, obviously we had the week off. I would go for the session, which we always had at Hope Valley Country Club in Durham. That's where he did all the on-course work with Payne. And I would go. So, you know, I was just reemphasizing everything Dick was teaching him because I was right there listening to it all. So it couldn't have been, it was like a perfect storm. You know what I mean? You know, I was a little more vocal than most of the caddies that he had, and the fact that I was there for the sessions with Dr. Koop. So it was like I said, a perfect storm.
Were you ever skeptical of Dr. Koop, or did you kind of buy into what he was presenting to Payne from the outset?
Well, I knew something was lacking, but you know, because like I said, we could have won all four tournaments, but on Sunday that it changed for Payne. You know, he wasn't quite as confident. He was, you know, it was always worrying about where not to go. And what Dick did was make him, Payne had no pre-shot routine when I first started working for him. So he was all over the map, you know, club out of the bag, taking swings, you know, no structure at all to his pre-shot. So Dick got him develop a pre-shot routine. And then the most important thing was picking an intermediate target out, which, you know, it's just like 2 feet in front of the ball. And that, if you can do that and have that ball and forget about what's in front of you, the OB, the bunkers, the trouble, and focus on that spot. And if that ball starts over that spot, you're going to hit the ball in play. Right. So that was the biggest thing is Payne not focusing what was in front of him and focusing on that intermediate target. As simple as that sounds, that's really the reason he won all the majors he won, is being able to bring his focus back into right in front of him as opposed to what was out ahead of him.
How long did that take for him to develop and then develop the confidence in when it mattered on a Saturday or a Sunday?
Probably a month or two. I can't really remember when we first put it all together. I know we lost in a playoff at one of the, like, opposite the World Series of Golf. They had a tournament in Tennessee somewhere. I forget where it was. Might have been Knoxville, maybe, or Chattanooga. It was in Chattanooga, and we lost in a playoff to, I think, Phil Blackmar. I think guy mate rolls in a 50 footer on the first playoff hole to beat us. But that right there, I mean, he and Phil Blackmar birdied the last two holes to get in the playoff. So Payne didn't beat himself using this new method. He got beat by somebody that performed better, you know, so he didn't beat himself for the first time. That's probably the first time. That's probably the beginning of his success, you know, with what Dick was teaching him.
Did that ultimately make him a more mentally tough golfer to have to do the same thing every time?
Yes, absolutely. 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 That changed his whole outlook and his whole mentality on the golf course, because he had structure. You know, it's like a putting stroke. You know, you're trying to replicate that putting stroke every time. You know, you're trying to make the same golf swing every time. Well, the pre-shot and the mental part of it, you're trying to do the same thing every time. If you look at Jason Day, he closes his eyes behind the ball every shot, paints the picture, right? There's a lot of guys that paint the picture, they just don't close their eyes.
Yeah.
A lot of guys are seeing that shot. That's a very important part of the pre-shot routine. They're seeing the shot. They're just not like Jason closing his eyes. And Payne was doing that too.
And how did that kind of confidence, pre-shot routine, thought process, did that translate to anything more positive in how he practiced and carried himself out, you know, non-tournament play?
I don't know that he changed, you know, that much away from the course or, you know, with how we practiced or warmed up. I do remember early on, to get used to picking the intermediate out, that he wouldn't just rapid fire. He would get back behind the ball and pick the spot out. You know, I know we did that for quite a while early on, you know, because you have to get used to doing that. And the thing about it, Ryan, in 1999, probably the three tournaments leading up to the US Open, he had gotten away from it, right? from picking the intermediate out. And I was noticing it, but I didn't say nothing. I didn't say a word to him. So we show up at, he misses the cut at Memphis. Sunday morning, we go out for a practice round. It's me, Payne, Chuck Cook, his swing coach, and Dick Coop. So we're walking down the first hole, and we're walking down two, and Dick comes up to me and says, "What's going on?" And Payne and Chuck are ahead of us. And I said, "For one thing, he's not picking his intermediate target out." He said, "Okay, okay." So we get on the third tee, and Payne's got his 3-iron out. You know, it's short par four. He's laying up. And he's over the ball. He's getting ready to hit it. And out of the, you know, from the side, Dick says, "Where's your intermediate?" And Payne looks up at him. Oh, okay. So from that point on in that practice round, he realized that he had not been doing it. And from that point on, he started picking his intermediate target out. And you know, the rest is history. So I really credit Dick. And I give myself a little credit for noticing that he wasn't doing it. Now, you know, I'd been with him so long, and, you know, before every shot, I would tell Payne, and it was habit. Every shot, I would say, get your spot, which is the intermediate, nice and slow, which is very important in his golf swing, was rhythm, right? Get your spot nice and slow. So I was to blame, too, because I was just going through the motions also. But I did notice that he wasn't doing it, and I relayed that to Dick. If I had said that to Payne, it wouldn't mean as much as his psychologist telling him, right?
Yeah.
And so I credit Dick, you know, a lot for Payne's success. I mean, had he not reached out and started doing that, I don't think he would have won the tournaments that he won. Yeah. Especially 99, without picking his intermediate, we'd have never won that tournament.
How difficult, I mean, obviously par was a huge factor that week in that U.S. Open.
Right.
How difficult was it, not relative to par, but relative to any other tests that you and Payne face?
Oh, it's always the most difficult. It used to be, and it's getting back to that. I think that you know, after Tom Meeks left and with the USGA, and then they moved on, and that regime, you know, taking it to public places and really setting it up a little, you know, like it. LA Country Club, you know, what did we have? 2 9-unders in one day or something, you know? I mean, Payne rolled over in his grave. I mean, so I think, and from what I understand, and that's why Pinehurst is back on the rover every 5 years, they want to bring the test back, you know, to where it's a real challenge. And let me tell you, number two, it played really difficult that week, right? In 99, but the USGA, I was there this year. I tip my hat to them because they could have gotten that place unplayable had they wanted. Par would have won, or over par could have won that tournament if they had wanted it. But they, you know, they softened it up. They didn't go crazy with it because first time playing on Bermuda greens. And you know, as the years go by, that garbage off the fairways is only going to get thicker, you know, and they had a lot of trouble with it this time. You know, I played it a month before the tournament, and there's still areas where you're going to have a shot, have a swing, can make solid contact, but it's getting less and less.
Yeah.
So I look for next time, you know, if they want par to win, it'll win for sure.
Payne's putting down the stretch of that 99 U.S. Open was unbelievable. I mean, given the pace of the greens, the pressure, mano-a-mano situation. Was there anything that was a key to his success in those moments that maybe he didn't know, or you knew and he didn't, or that maybe the public doesn't know?
No, I would say, you know, his wife picked up on the, you know, keep your head still after Saturday's round. He was moving a little bit, and he really, he putted well all week. And even though Saturday was not his best putting day, he putted good enough to, you know, still be in the lead. Yeah. But I'd have to say, you know, just making sure he stayed still. I mean, look, he had gone from, you don't win the tournaments he won without being a good putter. But once he got the Seymour putter, he became a great putter. And, you know, it's a shame that we only got to use it for a few months. You know, I mean, who knows what he could have done, you know, the way he was putting the ball with the Seymour. And there again, the Seymour is designed, it's not just a putter, it's a system. So it makes you set up the same way every time. It's the same routine, your same ball position, because you're using your belly button as a reference. I mean, it was, you know, it was perfect for him because it was structured and it made him do the same thing every time. And, you know, even we missed the cut at Disney, you know, right before he died. And we got done on Friday and we missed the cut. And he's like, let's go to the putting green. So we went to the putting green and he's like, you know, something's just not right. So we were looking at his setup and I said, well, you know, your left hand's not quite as cupped as it normally was. So he would cup his left hand like this and then keep that angle throughout the stroke. So we putted for about an hour. He said, you know, that's it, because I'm sore now. And I, when I first started using this thing, I felt the same thing. You know, I'm sore. He just didn't quite have the angle at address. And we had figured that out. And he was, you know, he started holding everything that last part of that hour that we were practicing. So that Seymour was perfect for him, structured, doing the same thing every time. Because pain, listen, I'd seen the guy go from heel up to toe down in the same round. Okay. So heel up, heel down, you know, flat, hands low, not make anything for six holes. All of a sudden now he's right on top of the ball, the toes down on the ground. He's way up on top of it. He would do anything to try and make putts. He was not scared to change it up mid round. So this, the Seymour really, really put structure in his stroke and in his, you know, and then listen, when you start making putts, you know, you gain confidence. It just frees everything up, you know?
Did he try to, between Dr. Coop, the Seymour putter, did he try to seek more structure professionally to try to kind of eliminate some variables?
I think he did all that, you know, in those, you know, in the part of it in the late 80s, early 90s, working with Dick Coop and Chuck Cook. You know, Chuck really, you know, Chuck was his coach, but Chuck, you know, didn't really mess with Payne's swing. You know, Chuck was more, if Payne got a little off, it was either rhythm, ball position, alignment, something like that, something simple. You know, and Chuck had a good eye to pick up on that stuff. But as far as changing the loop and, you know, if you would look at Payne Stewart's swing on film, you're never going to teach anybody that. It's just like Jim Furyk. You're never going to teach anybody to swing that way. And what goes wrong, you look at a guy like Matthew Wolf, who came out who on fire when he first came out. And I don't know what happened to Matthew Wolf, but I guarantee you somebody changed a little something in that swing he had, whether it was his grip, whether it was his takeaway, whatever it was. And now you haven't heard from him again. I know he's on the live, but he's done nothing over there. Yeah. So when you have your own unique way of doing things, I mean, look at Raymond Floyd. Nobody's ever going to teach a swing club like Raymond Floyd, but the guy was one of the greatest players ever. Trevino. So Payne, you know, Chuck really didn't do a whole lot with Payne's swing. Dick helped him with the mental part of it, you know, and then, you know, we got the Seymour putter. Arnie Cunningham has been a long time rep on tour, brought the Seymour putter to Payne. Here's a good story. Brought it to us at Pebble Beach on Wednesday. We're getting ready to go for a practice round. And Arnie says, hey, have you seen this putter? And Payne said, no. What this looks like? Where'd you get this? Kmart? And Payne says, oh, I'll check it out. Threw it in the bag. We never even touched it on the course. Played 9 holes. It had played beautifully for that first month, tee to green, but could not putt it in the ocean. We get done with the practice round for the 9 holes. He said, let's go down to the putting green at Pebble. So we go down to the Pebble, and he putted for about 3 hours with the Seymour. He putted so long that his back started hurting, and when it started hurting, he knew it was time to shut it down. He's, you know, we get done. He comes over. He says, what do you think? I said, look, dude, you can't putt any worse. Let's give it a shot. We win the tournament. Win the tournament. Putted lights out with this thing at Pebble on those greens.
Yeah.
And that, you know, rest was history with the putter. Just wish he had had, you know, a lot longer time with it, obviously.
Were you, how do you think about October 25th each year as it comes by? Does it get easier over time? How does that
Well, I mean, time heals all wounds. I mean, we're never going to get over that, the fact that he's not with us anymore. But, life goes on. We're still stuck here on this earth. At least he's in a better place than we are, in my opinion. I get phone calls from everywhere. All of his old friends, all the friends that we were mutually, had friendships with, we'll talk. It's kind of an annual event that we all talk on that day. And then you remember where you were, what you were doing. And so the memories are never going to leave you, but as life goes on, time heals all wounds. But, when you lose somebody like that, the way it happened, it's just still surreal. You know what I mean? That something like that can happen.
Yeah. Do you ever think about what maybe life would have been like had that day never happened? They had been playing the Champions Tour.
For sure. Absolutely. See, I think, Payne was in really good condition. He was one of the first guys, before the Tiger, athlete working out type stuff. Payne was working out back in the 90s, early 90s, because of his back. He knew he had to strengthen his core to keep his back good. So he was a workout guy. I mean, he was always, and I'm not saying he ate right or took care of himself that well, but he did work out on his body. So he was in good shape. Like I said, he had become a great putter. And, at 42, you've got the experience. I'd like to think, we would have, I'm not going to say we would have won more majors, but I feel surely we would have contended, certain ones, PGA, US Open, British Open, Masters. I'd like to have seen him putt those greens with the Seymour. Now we did putt him that 99 year, but the greens there spooked him. He just had a phobia about those greens, and we didn't putt that well, but I'd like to have seen him going back there two or three times with this putter. And maybe things would have been different, but I surely think he would have contended in some more majors. And he would have had a great career on Champions Tour. Absolutely.
He would have eaten
with
that
swing. I mean, his swing was long, and the older you get shorter. But, he was going to be able to play for a long time, just like Bernhard.
Right. Yeah, it seems kind of like the longer swing is kind of the secret to longevity.
The longevity, correct.
How often are you asked about Payne? How often do you speak about him? And
I do some speaking on my own, not only with Tour Caddy Collective, but like I did, I spoke Friday night, this past Friday night in Pinehurst to the Golf Heritage Society.
Yes.
You've heard of those guys, right?
I'm a member, yeah.
Oh, you're a member. So I went to their convention and spoke Friday night. Great bunch of people. And, 25th anniversary this past June, the 25th, his death coming up. So it was kind of a perfect timing for me to go and speak at their convention. And, people had a lot of questions about Payne, a lot of questions. I mean, the Q&A, I gave a little bio that lasted about 10 minutes or something, 15 minutes, and then opened it up for discussion. And we were 45 minutes into Q&A, and Bill Robertson had to kind of cut it off. It was around 10:15, and everybody in there is, not young, everybody's everybody in there is past their bedtime, right? he had to cut it off. It could have gone on for, there were people there that, after it was over, had several people come up and ask questions that they didn't get to ask, while I was up there. So, but it was a good night. I got good feedback from Bill earlier this weekend, and it was fun.
Do you think about this day with obviously sense of sadness, but also a sense of appreciation and happiness that Payne was a part of your life?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. I was very blessed to have known him, to have been involved in his life the way I was, 12 years with him, and the success we had. I mean, look, I had a blessed career. I wouldn't trade it for anything. I just wish it was in today's world with the money they're playing for. I was a few years too early for the success I had, you know, and my bank account would be a lot bigger. But no, I am grateful, and the tour was good to me, and Payne Stewart was good to me, and you know, I miss that, you know, when you have somebody like that, and that's why I never got another job that lasted more than 3 years, 4 years, or something, because it just was never the same ever.
Yeah.
Not that I changed the way I caddied, and I meshed with several guys personality wise. We got along. Some guys I didn't like, some guys I did. But it was just never the same, you know, never the same. Payne and I got to the point where we could say anything to each other. And I never got to the point with anybody else that that could happen.
Is that kind of the measure of the man, the person you're caddying for, is that you can have that kind of level of candor with somebody?
That's where you want to get. That's, you know, that's where you want to get. But there, I'm going to say this too. You know, listen, there aren't many Payne Stewarts or Jack Nicklauses of the world. Tiger to an extent. Tiger was not hard on his caddy at all. It didn't seem to me like, I wasn't out with Tiger that much, but I never saw him berate Steve or anything. Nicklaus never, Payne never. Today's world, I'm not really sure if there is anybody playing that doesn't take responsibility for a bad shot or a bad decision, because ultimately they're the one that's got to make the call. They're hitting the shot, right? They can ask your advice, but Payne always said, listen, I don't have to listen to you, right?
Right.
I got the final decision. And there's not many guys left that will own up to their, take ownership of their golf game. You know, I mean, the last guy I caddied for, and I don't care if you put this out there, but Brendan Todd was one of the really good players, solid player, but he just has no self-confidence and is, you know, it's always something, somebody else's fault or something's fault that if something bad happened, you know, and it's sad, but that's just reality. You know, he lacks self-confidence. And that's all it is. He's a great player, could be a really good player if he had a little more of that.
Is there anything, any piece of advice from your time with Payne, your caddy career, or your relationship together that you would pass along to the current generation or next generation that maybe is different now or has maybe been lost?
I would say try to get to the point where your caddy is almost like family. You know, because that's where I got with Payne. You know, try to get close enough that you are involved with your, you know, you're not just an employee. You know, you're not employer employee. You're a friend. You're your families are close. I would just say try and get as close personally as you can with your player. And I think if that happens, then the guy that you're caddying for is not going to be somebody that whips you or, you know, berates you on the golf course, because there's nothing worse. Now, listen, I have thick skin. I could take it. I worked for some guys, Norman for a couple of weeks, Tom Kite, you know, listen, those type guys, you had to have thick skin because they were going to bark at you. And people think that Curtis Strange was that way. Curtis Strange was only hard on himself. He never berated me ever. And I caddied for him a lot. But Curtis would kill himself, but he really never blamed his caddy, you know, not when I caddied for him. He never blamed me for anything. Blamed himself a lot. But I would just say, you know, try to get as close as you can, you know, personally with your player, you know, get involved in his life and, you know, things will be a lot easier.
Is there one story, not inside the ropes, is there one story that you might go to kind of explain Payne Stewart to people in your relationship with him?
Well, we're in Ireland, went over there to play prior to the British Open. And it was a smorgasbord of players, Tiger, Lee Jansen, Markham, Mira, Stuart Appleby, Payne. Let me think who else was there. I don't know if Baker Finch was there or not. Anyway, there's five or six players there that are, you know, Tiger at the time's, you know, basically number one in the world. I think this was like, it's probably 98, probably. I think it was 98. Anyway, so we're in Waterville, Ireland. And, you know, Payne liked to have a good time. Tracy was there. Payne says, let's go to the pub in town. I said, all right, I'll go with you. Tracy didn't want to go. So we go up there. It's probably 9-10 o'clock at night. Well, it's say 2 a.m., 3 a.m. maybe. He's behind the bar. And this place is, they, you know, word got out that he's in there. He's behind the bar serving drinks. And I'm at the bar. I'm just not moving. You can't move. People were everywhere. But I got a little spot at the bar, and I'm just watching him, right? Watching him pour these drinks. You know, he's passing everything out. Finally, I said, hey, this is after about 30 minutes. I said, you know, you do realize you got to charge these people for these drinks, don't you? You mean I haven't been doing that? I says, no, you haven't charged a soul. I said, yeah, but you've given away so much alcohol, you know, to these people. So that was fun. That was a fun night. He was, you know, people playing the piano. He was singing. Listen, it was the sun comes up early over there anyway, but it was light out when we came back to the hotel. I mean, and then, so then I think we got about 2 hours sleep, and then we're taking a helicopter to go play Old Head. You heard of that place? Yeah. Yes. We're going to play Old Head on 2 hours of sleep. That was a fun day, let me tell you. But just stuff like that. And another time, I remember we were in Scotland. We'd gone over the week before. And we arrived into Glasgow. And we go down to the hotel. We're eating dinner. We got a flight over there that we got in later in the day and not in the morning, you know. Because I do remember getting there and just going right to the hotel. And we're eating dinner. And Payne says to the barkeep there at the hotel, he says, is there any bar? Because it's Sunday night. We're over there on Sunday nights. Well, there is a place down the street. And so we go down the street, and there's a bunch of kids in there, college kids from North Carolina. They're over there studying abroad for the summer. They're all from a college up in the mountains of North Carolina. Might have been Brevard College. So this place closed at 11. So somebody got word that there was a place open all night. So, and it's about a mile walk. So here we go out the door of this one bar, and he's walking, he's in front, and there's probably 60 college kids. And I'm in the very back watching this all go down. And I started calling him the Pied Piper, you know, because that's what it looked like. He's leading the way, and he got 60 college kids following him. I was like, man, this is unreal. But he just liked to have fun. And, you know, he was nice to people. And listen, you wouldn't know who he was without the garb on. He had no idea who this guy was. No idea. Well, he had to produce the U.S. Open trophy when he went to Pebble, you know, for Media Day in 92, after we'd won in 91. He had to go and bring the trophy down because the people that were in the tap room there didn't believe it was him. Yeah, didn't believe it was him. The guy said, listen, if you can produce the U.S. Open trophy, I'll buy you all the Cristal you can drink. Of course, that was all Payne had to hear. He hopped up, went upstairs, got the trophy, came back down. You know, the guy said, you are Payne Stewart. He said, I'll have one bottle now, but that might not be the last one. So he drank Cristal all night that night. But you never knew who it was because of practice rounds. He's in slacks, ball cap. You know, you'd have to look at his bag to see who it was, right? So he had the best of both worlds. Very recognizable on TV, on the golf course, and then off the golf course, incognito. Just another blonde, right? People didn't know him. It's good. It was a good camouflage for him.
That is true. That is true. He probably knew it pretty well too.
Yeah, he did. He did.
Well, Mike, thank you for doing this. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no worries, Ryan.
This is awesome. This is so cool.
Yeah, no worries. Enjoyed it.
Thank you again to Mike for being on the show. I really appreciate it. It was a wonderful conversation. If you'd like to view the video version of that conversation. It's available on Golf News Net TV, as well as through our website, golfnewsnet.com, and our YouTube channels, if you're so inclined. Thanks for spending some time with me. I very much appreciate it. We'll be back with another show soon. I'm Ryan Ballingy. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.